what is the network for systemic impact? What does this all mean, and what is really an approach for building an organization's capacity to innovate? We wanted to invite Kippy Joseph from the Rockefeller Foundation to start us off and give us a little bit of framework that's going to guide us through today's discussion. So Kippy, welcome to today's webinar, and we'll let you guide us.
Great. Thank you so much, Charlie, and thank you to all of you who are joining from around the world. As Charlie mentioned, I work at the Rockefeller Foundation, which in 2013 will turn 100 years old. And the foundation has a 100-year history of innovation. For example, when a young Albert Einstein asked a lieutenant at the foundation for a $500 grant, the program officer said, "Let's give him $1,000. He may be on to something." So that was typical of what the foundation did in those days, which was test and experiment and then adapt based on what they had learned. And that looks a lot like many of the aspects of innovation today. We think innovation is important at the foundation in part because we know that the challenges facing poor or vulnerable people around our globe are evolving with greater speed and unpredictability than ever before, and that the solution requirements tend to be interdependent. That can be defined as a wicked problem from that theory from the 70s, but I think everyone can relate to that. When you create one solution, it often begets a new problem. So what is required is not only increased efficiency and performance gained with any particular way of addressing a pressing social need, but also innovation. And we believe that innovation is a critical capacity for solving the most pressing social need that the foundation is trying to address. So you'll see on your screen, I hope, a definition of innovation. It's quite lengthy. I won't read through it, but I think if you are seeing it, you'll see that the foundation thinks about a couple of things when it thinks about innovation. One is the discontinuousness from previous practice of a product, a process, or a service. That often means encountering assumptions and challenging those assumptions that may be underlying the way in which current practice is being conducted. One of the other things I'll just draw out from that definition is the idea that social innovation, meaning innovation that addresses social need and that has systemic impact, is recombinant. Now, that's just a fancy word for pushing things together and coming up with new ideas based on existing elements. The last word I want to pull out of that definition is the word wake. One of my colleagues mentioned this recently, that there's a nice metaphor, there's a nice visual of wake, because often innovation is most impactful not from a particular product or process, but from the ripple effect that it has and what it leaves in its wake. Usually we find that social relationships are stronger and healthier as a result of social innovations. So we know that while single innovations are important and innovations that reach their maximum impact are important, but how do we get those? For the last year and a half, the foundation has been focused on the organizational capacity to innovate. There's no silver bullet. There's no formula for what it looks like for an organization to embody this capacity, but we have distilled several aspects or several competencies that organizations have when they demonstrate a capacity for continuous innovation. One of those is the ability to engage a network beyond an organization's borders to think broadly about having systemic impact, meaning impact beyond the group of people that you may be serving or the law or the government that you may be influencing. It's thinking much more broadly than that and using your network outside your borders to achieve those aims. I really want to thank our panelists, Mary and Mark and Eric, for joining us today. They were invited in part because each of their organizations has really demonstrated the capacity to innovate over time, and each of those organizations do this bit of it particularly well. They engage networks outside their own organizations to achieve their aims. They each do it in a different way, and so we like to think of these aspects of innovation as ingredients, and everybody mixes the ingredients together in their own recipe to serve up a fresh new dish. But I think we're all looking forward to hearing from the three panelists about what that particular recipe looks like in their organizations. So I'm personally excited to hear more about how they have leveraged their network to forward their works and contribute to large-scale systemic change. I imagine you are too. So I will turn it back over to Charlie to engage them.
So to get us kicked off, the first question is probably just a natural one. What does an engaged network look like in practice? So in the day-to-day work of being at an organization where you have an engaged network and you're building that capacity to innovate, how does it actually look? So Mary, why don't you start us off in telling us a little bit about how that works at WinRock?
Okay, so what I'd like to do is tell you about how we use WOW visits, which you'll understand in a moment, as a means of engagement. In order to kind of set the context, let me tell you about the situation that we were in. We had a challenge in early 2009. WinRock began a new MUS water project in Morogoro, Tanzania. It was a new approach. We were using new technologies, and it was a new area that we were working in. In order to get things up and going, we needed to get buy-in and support from a very skeptical and diverse group of stakeholders, local government, communities, the private sector. And we needed to move really fast. We had some challenges in working in the consortium we were with, and we had significant delays in startup, and the pressure was on us to get people up and going. So we decided to use what we coined the WOW visits as a means to engage a skeptical and diverse group of actors that we needed to get involved. So here's what we did. We had another NGO that we were working with in a very remote area of Tanzania, down in the south in an area called Njombe. They were doing some of the work that we wanted to include in our project area. And so what we did is we got folks from local government, engineers, leaders, we got community members, and also the private sector. We wanted to work with some small ma-and-pa type operations. We put them all together on a bus, and we brought them down to Njombe for what we called the WOW visit. In the WOW visit, they were able to go out and look and see and feel, see what was happening on the ground, talk to their counterparts with local government, and ask the tough questions for themselves to see, hey, is this something that they were interested in? We worked collectively as a group, and then we also worked with them individually. We had the private sector people, people who we wanted to manufacture pumps for us, talk to pump makers in Njombe. We had local government people talk to local government people. We had community members talk to community members. What was so great about it is that almost all the participants came back interested and engaged and willing to go to work. It worked amazingly well. And the thing that was so great about it is that because they were able to touch and see and feel it, they themselves were able to talk to their counterpart once they got back home. So community members were able to talk to community members and local government, and private sector and kind of share the news. So this was an example where we had a challenge and we needed to get people engaged quickly, and how we sort of jump-started that whole process of engagement through the WOW visits. And as we talk a little bit more about some of these other questions, I'll refer back to this example and tell you how that network has continued to work for us.
Perfect. Great example of exactly how those networks are coming together on that day-to-day basis. And I think what's great is when you first hear that WOW visit, you assume you're bringing people from the outside and wowing them. But the reality is it's everybody's getting wowed, and it is down to the community members on the ground who are taking action. It's a great example. Mark, what about you? What's an example of how networks are activated and engaged on a daily basis in your organization?
We have a lot of networks that we use that are more the traditional networks that are partners, let's say, in the field. An example of establishing a new one was that about 4 years ago, we were focusing on improving our capacity to respond in humanitarian crises. And one of the tools that we knew that we really needed to use in these types of situations was the use of digital mapping. And our focus here was really to get information to the local population. The reason for that was that we were really focused on using local media to make sure that the local population was actually empowered to play a more active role in the humanitarian response and be much less of a recipient or a passive recipient of aid. In our organization, we really didn't have the resources or the expertise as well as the bandwidth to really focus on developing a better understanding on how to use these digital maps. And with the establishment of the International Crisis Mappers Network, we were able to attend their first gathering, introduce ourselves to a lot of technologists that were entering into this space. And then about 8 months later, during the Haitian earthquake, a lot of these people who had been, a lot of the developers who had actually been at this conference, were showing up in this humanitarian crisis, many for the first time. And because of our experience in the humanitarian area, especially humanitarian information, we were first both able to really kind of assist in interfacing that. But most importantly is that we were able to work with them on the tools that they had with regard to making sure those were connected to local media, so that the local radio stations were actually became a really a key link to the ability for people using these specific tools to improve humanitarian information, to make sure that that got out to the general population and they were more engaged. And then at the same time is also showing how through that medium we could actually make it much more interactive, that we could get much more input from the local population through call-in shows and other interactive programs. And then finally, at the next International Crisis Mappers Conference, once again, we were able to establish, because of what we had been able to establish with them and networking in the field, is to really reinforce within that community, as they were becoming increasingly influential in this space, is really to help stress the need, or the critical need, for as information systems and networks were being put together during humanitarian crises, and as many of these tools were being developed to be used by or for the humanitarian organizations, was really to stress the importance that that information which is gathered, even if it is for humanitarian operations, is also rendered accessible to the local population, those in greatest need. And it really has had a kind of a multiplying effect as we've moved forward through emergency to emergency.
Perfect. Another great example. And it's interesting to see the comparison just between what Mary and Mark talked about. Mary really was describing pulling together a network, really weaving something together that had really immediate impact on an on-the-ground, very specific location of a project. And Mark, what I heard you talk about, at least in part, was engaging a network, a mappers network, that was already put together by another organization, tapping into it, becoming part of it, and really becoming a leader in that. So it's interesting to see that networks don't always have to be built yourself. You can really tap into them from other organizations as well. So Eric, why don't you respond to this as well?
It's great to have Mark on the line because what I'm about to talk about dovetails in perfectly. So, you know, when you ask what do engaged networks look like, I think the easy answer is messy. There's a lot that happens behind the scene. There's a lot of people talking to each other, trying to work with each other, and organizations that are the cultures might not fit perfectly. But there's a great quote by Harry Truman, which is, it's amazing what you can accomplish if you don't care who gets the credit. And I think, you know, having a veteran organization like Internews with us in Haiti was kind of case in point for that for us. It was them helping us to understand the reality of the disaster and emergency response on the ground, connecting us with other organizations, us working with other organizations outside of them as well, and putting together a platform, really, that hadn't been done before, which would allow ordinary Haitians to send in information, and then we would route that information to the right organization. So behind the scenes, behind the simple map that most people saw, behind the radio ads put out by Internews, was actually a kind of a convoluted and messy system. But by each organization being willing to work with each other and understand that the greater good came from helping each other rather than working against each other, we were able to get something out there. So I think that's one of the big lessons learned for us. And this was 2.5 years ago now. And the real lesson that Ushahidi as an organization took away from that was that we needed to make sure that we stayed small, we stayed fast, but we also stayed connected to other organizations, because by ourselves, we couldn't do nearly as much as the whole group combined could do. And, you know, that has been kind of permeated the rest of our deployments and the rest of the activities we do around community as well. And it showed us that most of the time, the individuals and the organizations who make up our greater community, do much more than we alone as Ushahidi do. We just create the platform, and it's they who actually make that platform work and have true impact on the ground.
Great, and I love that answer of what do networks really look like in action. Well, they look messy. And I think from our experience, that's absolutely true. It's one of those approaches that you take to building capacity in your organization that requires a lot of work, a lot of nurturing, and as Eric said, and certainly was present in both Mary and Mark's answers as well, it takes a lot of connection, takes a lot of nurturing of real relationships. How do you get real positive impact that even leads to more innovation? Mary, why don't you talk to us a little bit about the impact you all have seen for the WOW visits?
Okay, this is connected to that project. So what I'd like to talk about is our work building a vibrant local network in Tanzania to expand our impact and creating a global training course in the process. Stepping back to the example in Tanzania, we're now shifting forward from 2009 to 2011. In 2011, the project in Tanzania was well on its way. We were achieving all of our targets, but we had a pesky ongoing problem. We weren't spending enough money. We were reaching all our targets, but our burn rate was lower than anticipated, partially because we were relying on lower cost technologies, and the donor was clamoring for us to spend. Simultaneously, the innovative new approach to water services that I described earlier that we were piloting called MUF was beginning to take off globally. And WinRock was receiving all sorts of requests about how to do MUF. So we were grappling with how to meet these demands. We really had two good problems on our hands, how to utilize the extra funding that we had to responsibly expand our impact, and how to share what we were learning with a much larger audience. So this is what we did. We decided to develop a training course to bring in seven NGO partners that we had been working with in our project, but they had been sort of coming into our project area. We decided to bring them together, provide them with training, and offer them the potential for seed funding to implement MUS in their own project areas. It was a very daunting task, actually. We brought in our global Moose team from all over the world, WinRock's team. We sat together, we designed the course, and then we tested it. And there's this picture you're seeing is from the testing that we did with our local partners. You can't see in the window in the back, but there were a couple vervet monkeys that were very interested in what MUS is all about. And we gave the training program, which allowed us to test and vet the program to use elsewhere. And we also got our partners to understand more about what MUS was about, and then we offered them seed funding. We did some hand-holding with them in their proposal development and also went with them in the field. And to date, we've given out approximately $1 million in small grants to these seven different organizations. Something actually amazing has happened as a result of it. We were working in Morogoro, Tanzania, and suddenly all of our work is replicating and scaling nationally. We have partners now up in Arusha, Mwanza in the northwest, in the south we're with Njombe, Ifakara, and into the west we're into Iringa. And this network, what's been so fantastic about it, besides expanding our impact, the sharing that has gone on, for example, we've learned from one of our partners in Ifakara, they have a very unique sort of hybrid private sector community-based approach for water service delivery that's helped our thinking. And in fact, we've even taken those ideas now and introduced them in our projects in West Africa. And so this very dynamic, innovative group that keeps learning and working together has been very unforeseen and has been a fantastic result of the creation of this vibrant new network. And in the process, we've also gotten this great training program that we've been able to roll out and share to help others learn about MUF and how to implement it.
This is a great story, Mary, and certainly a great picture. And for those of you who have enough clarity on your screen, you do get to see a little bit of those monkeys who are watching the training. So it was obviously incredibly compelling. And I think what's interesting for me is that the statement that you had donors clamoring to spend money, which is a great problem that I think everyone on the call would love to have. but maybe more importantly, it's how you use that money, that you spend it utilizing the network to share and scale what you were already doing. And that's the whole opportunity arose because really utilizing a network was actually less expensive than doing it yourself, building that organization, which we actually heard Eric talk a little bit about as well. So shifting a little bit, let's go to Mark and hear about how you guys are actually creating real impact on the ground.
Okay, I think another example of a network or a problem that we faced and how we were able to address it through networks is that in Kenya, the government of Kenya was one of the first in Africa to open its data or to follow the example of the U.S. and the World Bank and making its data open to the general public. And we had a long and well-established network of journalists that we had been working with there. And so we took advantage of that opportunity to work with them on how to report on that data, how to pull it out and really kind of, you know, make these huge data sets relevant to the general population. And what we quickly learned was that they did not have a lot of experience, as with journalists all over the world, often don't have much experience with managing these huge data sets. We had already hooked into the network of Kenyan hackers that Eric had established through the iHub, and that through that, we were able to really connect a lot of coders and other technologists with a group of journalists to put together apps and other applications that made it easier for the journalists to pull that data out, understand it better, identify trends that were of importance, and then start to really build some interesting stories, making that information relevant to the general population. Where we really saw this was a really great example of just how things can take off, because we kind of started to develop a certain approach and methodology for this, but then Eric and some of his people developed another approach, and so now you have a whole series of different projects that are moving forward through these networks addressing this really key issue of how do you make these large data sets relevant in this government data. I think another thing which was really important here was that we used these examples when connecting with universities that were particularly the information school and UC Berkeley, that were very interested in issues of data literacy, because we also felt these were very important, because in a lot of situations where you have illiterate populations, how are you going to, you know, make these data sets really relevant? So that through, again, expanding even further into another network, into the academic field, we're able to now start to put together a program in which we're looking and identifying new methodologies, whether it be information graphics or others, to really make these vast amounts of data which are being released through open data initiatives or big data sets and make that really accessible and relevant to the poorest of the poor. And so this has been really exciting because it just seems to keep on expanding.
I think it's really interesting to hear you talk through that, because a couple things that I pull out is, one, you really understood how you were engaging the network and who that network consisted of. So it was a very discrete group of technologists and journalists that you were targeting, not sort of everyone out there or everyone involved in the problem. And you really understood how you were connecting them to issues like data literacy. So I think, once again, sometimes when we think about networks or even broader communities, it starts to feel like everyone in the world could get engaged, and possibly they could be, but it's always being really targeted and understanding what you're offering them and how you're really going to get that impact. So I think that's really helpful. Eric, why don't you jump off of what Mark was talking about, since you guys have worked together quite a bit. There'll probably be a lot of natural segue there.
When we think about engaged networks and how they help us as an organization become more innovative, it's sometimes a little bit easier for us because of where we're from. You know, the history of Ushahidi was coming out of Kenya's post-election violence in 2008. And then we built this open source platform. That open source platform made us have to engage with other people outside of ourselves in the very beginning. We just simply could not build what we needed to build on our own. We needed others' help, which in turn led to our organization being more open. And since, you know, the four of us were bloggers as well, it made it easier for us to reach out. We kind of had a knack for doing that in this open way. We still blog almost everything, so that it's a very open communication. What that allows us to do is when big things happen somewhere, to quickly connect And the example I kind of have here is another major event happened last year, the tsunami and earthquake in Japan. And here, the lesson that we learned was that the technology, of course, itself isn't the main thing. It's, like we often say, it's 10% of the problem. The other 90% is the management, it's the team, it's the administration, it's the messaging, all these other things that many organizations already do and do quite well. But that technology, what it allows you to do is overcome great inefficiencies in the system. And it allows small teams, individuals, to have great impact far beyond what you would normally expect. And in this case, Japan was a perfect case point because it started off with just a couple guys in a room who were OpenStreetMap guys, and they set up a map using Ushahidi and said, okay, send your information here. And it quickly grew to other people in the organizations around them that knew them, and then it grew beyond that and started just snowballing into thousands upon thousands of people taking part. Eventually, it was so big that the government also was playing a part in this. And we've seen this over and over again, from New Zealand to Pakistan as well. And I think that's really what I'm most interested in here, is that we see these small organizations, these or individuals themselves, taking simple technology and being able to leverage that into a much greater change. And when we see that kind of thing as an organization, as Ushahidi, we say, okay, this innovation that's been done out here, how can we take this back into our organization and learn from it? So when we saw Japan, the story for us wasn't that it was a massive deployment. It wasn't that it was a great use of our technology. It was actually more that we had, you know, a small group of people able to do a great amount of things. So what other tools could we create that allowed individuals to overcome the barriers usually put in front of them and to help them change the way the information flows in the world? So we don't just have this kind of structured top-down information from the normal players, but also bottom-up information from ordinary people.
It's so interesting to hear that in some ways what you're talking about is the opportunity for networks to address that very traditional answer to solving problems, which is build a really big, large, scaled organization. And instead, you're talking about being flexible, being nimble, being small, just as I think Mary and Mark have, going out and leveraging what already exists and like-minded peers to solve those really big problems. And the pace at which you can grow is vastly faster and more efficient than what the traditional methods have seen. And I think you guys have some really good case studies on the ground impact to show that. So the next question has got to logically be, so how do you do this? And maybe more particular, what tools or tactics does your organization use to establish and maintain these networks? So Mary, why don't you give us an example of a tool that you use at WinRock to keep your network active and managed well?
Sure. What I'd like to talk about is creating this animated video that we did to share, to engage a larger network in our new approach to water services that we were working on. Let me give you the context, because it's kind of a funny context behind it. In 2010, the Rockefeller Foundation decided to explore MUS as a new potential investment area. And in about mid-2011, I was having a debrief with our program officer right after a board meeting. And Christina said to me that Sandra Day O'Connor, and I don't know how many of you know her, she is a retired Supreme Court Justice, a U.S. Supreme Court Justice, and the first woman on the Supreme Court. And she said, "MOOC sounds too technical." And we were pretty stunned, and we thought, well, in order for this idea to really take off and for us to engage a larger audience and get broad-scale buy-in for MUS, if Sandra Day O'Connor, this brilliant Supreme Court justice, couldn't understand what it's about, and it's a really simple idea, we had a big problem on our hands. So we decided to step out of our NGO sort of development comfort zone and work to create a short animated video to explain what MUS was in simple and compelling ways. For any of you who are interested, maybe after the call, you can look on YouTube. It's called Keeping the Water Flowing, and it's a two-minute animated video that will give you a sense of our work. The challenge was to explain what we were doing in a simple and compelling way to increase interest and engagement. And the reason that we used the video, which I think that the animated video is worth mentioning, is that We decided to go with animation rather than pictures because we wanted to do two things. First of all, when people see animation, they naturally tend to relax and they're more receptive. We've all got kind of our blinders on or our lenses that we look at things through. And by using animation, it allows us to relax. The second thing is it allows people to see the ideas that are presented in the video, and then they can attach them to their own context. And we know they're coming from a variety of contexts. So the animation was an interesting tool, I think, that we used. The video has been incredibly successful for engaging people. It's just been a fabulous tool. And each time I start it, particularly for a group, I chuckle inside and I say, Sandra Day O'Connor, this video goes out to you. I don't know if she's actually ever seen it, which you should ask Kippy about. But that's one tool we've used. Two other related tools for that sort of the entry-level tool for engagement. The second one is we developed a very visually appealing guide to MUS, working with IDEO.org, the human-centered design firm in San Francisco. And then for folks that want to dig a little bit deeper, we've now developed this training course as well, and we're working on other types of tools. So my encouragement to people who are listening is think about different ways, different things, methods and tools that you could use to engage people and networks.
Perfect. And I like the idea of almost starting off with a communications tool, which is not something that people always think about for networks. Mark, let's move over to you and how you guys are using tools or tactics to engage and manage your network.
Thank you. I'm also just going to kind of wrap in a little answer to somebody was talking about reaching out to different networks. One of the things, and this is referencing back to what Eric said, is that they are messy, and I think that it's important that we look at them as happening at all different kinds of levels. Some of them will be very engaged. Some of them will be less engaged. Some of them might be temporary connections having to do with a specific situation or event, and others might be longer term and become more formal. And I think all of those are very relevant, and it's not important to really clearly define one. And one of the tools that we used in a situation we had a few years ago in one of our regions where traditional journalism was going by the wayside because of new information technologies, and there was a large number of really experienced journalists that had been contributing significantly to their communities, but because a lot of them were from the traditional media sector, it was very possible that those media outlets they were working for were actually going to shut down. And the networks that they had pre-established were not necessarily the networks that were going to help them address this problem, as many of those people had similar issues. And so we implemented a social innovation camp. And the idea there was to get our more traditional journalists connected with a very different set of people, with technologists, with people who were working in communities and doing, whether it be citizen journalist networks or other approaches, and to really get them thinking very differently about how they could use some of these new tools in getting information out to their communities and kind of reaching across, you know, different sectors. And what was most interesting about this kind of cross-fertilization was that it was not just the new information technology types that were very interested in actually learning something, or that there was a connection to traditional journalists, that in some cases they kind of looked at them as dinosaurs, but once they actually sat down in a room and started working on some innovative projects with them, they realized that there was a lot of crossover. But with some of the technologists, it was very interesting to see how they started to see the importance of just media in general, or how to use media, whether it be the new IT or whether it be some of the more traditional. And I think that one of the things that worked best about this gathering was that it was not a one-off meeting. It was not just an encounter and then everyone went their separate ways. Because we had various pilots that were developed, group projects, if you will, or that were developed in this week together, those spun off, and people that were together in a room but then separated across, you know, regions continued to work on these together. But then there were others, like I was saying earlier, that were less frequent, but continue to influence the way they thought about things, the way they approached their work, the ongoing relationships that they would then start to develop with other people in their own region. So it was a way of actually opening them up so that they actually started looking more at networks themselves. So it was an important tool for us, and what we're doing now is that we're realizing that that social innovation camp has to be very different wherever we use it, or just an innovation camp is a tool, whether it's in northern Pakistan or whether it's in Kenya. It is a tool that has to be adapted each time to the audience. I mean, this is one of the important things, I think, with a lot of different tools is the flexibility that we need to see with them.
Excellent example and a good pointer for everybody to make sure that they are thinking about the customization towards either geographic or cultural nuances that certainly will be required for many of the participants listening. So Eric, let's hear about tools and tactics you use at Ushahidi.
You know, at Ushahidi, we came from a kind of a non-traditional background, and our team has never been in the same country. In fact, we're across 7 different time zones. The founders didn't actually meet in person as a group until a year and a half into the organization's existence. So it's always been a little bit different for us. And by that, I mean that we've had to come up with different tools to communicate, number one, but also made us form our organization in a way that has a lot of trust built into it, because you can't wait 7 hours for somebody to wake up when a decision has to be made around some type of crisis or disaster. So, you know, a couple things that we do is that when people join the team, you'll often find them in their first month out there speaking to someone out there in the world in an event about Ushahidi. This, number one, shows that we trust. Number two, gets them out there facing individuals who might be using the software and having to explain it. And it helps us show that we trust them, number one. Number two, helps them show that they know what they're talking about. And though they might say it a different way than me or Juliana or David, they understand the ethos and can get the point across. It also means that they're much more confident about making decisions on their own in a timely manner when there might not be anybody awake to help them with the problem. The second thing we've done is, because we're so distributed, we also build different types of vehicles that allow for interaction with other organizations and other individuals. For example, at Ushahidi, Patrick helped us build the Crisis Mappers network out. The Crisis Mappers was just a loose connection of people. Really, it allowed for the online serendipity of people just kind of meeting up and finding out about each other. And then when something happened, they formed together, and then out of this comes the Standby Task Force, which helps with crises and disasters around the world. And from the same group of people came the International Conference on Crisis Mapping, which, you know, if you think about those three different networks that have been created, we're now dealing with both small and large organizations. People who are both intimidated and excited about what we do. So that's very exciting to me, as somebody has to kind of lead the organization and think about strategy for everything. It means that we have our links into these people before they're needed. A second example of this is we built the iHub in Nairobi, and that too is not about ownership for us. It's about us creating a platform that a bunch of people can come into. New and exciting ideas abound, and we're just one of those groups, or one of those, or members in that whole network. And that allows ideas to permeate, ideas to shift, ideas to pass from one person to another. And you never know who's going to create the next thing. And so we've hired out of the iHub, but we've also run hackathons and different type of events that people have taken our ideas and spun them out into new things that we wouldn't have thought of. And we've received other people's ideas and internalized them for new features within the software itself.
What's great about these three answers for me is that they stretch a continuum of engaging a network. So the first one, how do you actually do communications from Mary's example? The second one, of how do you really create network engagements from Mark? And then Eric really talking about the organizational structure and culture necessary for networks to be engaged effectively. And I think for all of us listening in here, if we just took those three elements alone, how do we communicate what we're doing and communicate to a network? How do we think about creating engagements? We're actually bringing that network together to solve real problems. And then what is it that we need to do at our own organizations to build our culture and our acceptance and our own capacity to engage them will probably go a long ways. A question that came through a while ago was, how do you ensure that your organization feeds its work back out to this larger community and contribute to a lasting systemic impact? So how do you keep this community engaged? You talked a little bit about it, but maybe you could go a little deeper and with a couple more examples.
It's kind of a difficult question to answer because I think some of what we do is not well thought out. A lot of what we do is just engage all the time with people as much as possible, make sure we're at the events, make sure we're talking to different organizations. And we don't necessarily always know where they go. I mean, a good quote around this is that, you know, we don't necessarily have a map for where we're going, but we do have a compass. And so when we're dealing with organizations, we want to work with the large organizations who are trying to internalize this technology that they think, well, it is disruptive for them in some ways, but it doesn't make them obsolete, and trying to get them to understand that. And then there's also the other part of the outreach, which is to the individual coders and developers or the smaller deployers of the software, and just keeping a link with them, you know, to that purpose. Inside the organization, we have a person whose job is to just deal with the community. So Heather Leeson is that person for us, and she's fantastic. She's always linking out to these other people, and then not just for us to link to them and them to link to us, but for them to link to each other. So connecting them as much as possible so that they're learning from each other as well.
I think it's great, and the candid response of it's not always clear and you don't always have an answer, I think, is really important. And one of the things that we've seen, and certainly as I've heard in each of your answers that you've provided today, is part of it, you just got to get out there and try, and you've got to go and engage, be in active conversations, listen, and then be able to respond in that dynamic aspect. And I think that is what's challenging about networks, is that at times it seems like there should be a formula or a easy-to-use process, but the reality is it's a lot of just management of good relationships, and that just takes time, and it takes lots of listening. So, Mary, another question that we got here was, how do you know what approach to use when starting or tapping into a particular network? So when you're getting something started and you're seeing that there's a new opportunity, how do you know where to start?
Yeah, I think that's a really excellent question. So I think the first thing is you got to sit back and think about, what's your goal? What do you want out of this interaction? Do you want, is it you're looking for active engagement, people to take on roles, for support? You want people not to block things. So you have to be very clear on what your overall goal is and what you want people to do. So I think that's the first step. The second step is this already an organized network that you're trying to tap into, or are you trying to create one? So the second thing is to figure out what is in the interest and what's occupying the individuals or the group that you want to engage in. So you really, it's kind of going back to communications 101, but it's trying to really identify your audience and figure out what's important to them and what would be their incentive structure for engagement. What's in it for them, and why might they not be interested in engaging? Because I saw a question come through on that. So trying to figure that out. For me, the first, so kind of having those two things out there, and sometimes you don't really know because you have sort of an idea that this person could do something or this organization, but you don't really have a clear understanding of their interests or their capabilities until you're actually engaged. So for me, one thing that I think is important in establishing that first engagement is to set out your vision, what you want to happen, what do you think these individual organizations could do, and then to actually go meet face-to-face. I think that is the best thing if you can do face-to-face, and start off with listening and sharing information. I think go there and say, hey, would you get into this network and make all these assumptions? First, you kind of need to listen to a little bit and take that person exactly where they're at and find out what they're working on, and then in a very simple way, try to connect them to what you're doing to see if there's a fit there. And one small pointer on that last piece, I see this happening over and over and over again, that when people are trying to get others involved in a, maybe it's in a certain topic or action, they have a difficult time sketching out the big picture. Helping people understand what the overall vision is and the big picture allows them to find their own connections in. So I can't stress the importance of being able to lay out a very clear and succinct idea of what it is you want them to get engaged in. Is that helpful?
I think it's extremely helpful, and it's really clear to think about that and to go back to some basics, as you mentioned, of just sort of the communications 101. Know who your audience is, know what they're interested in, and really go out there and have that face-to-face or that high-touch contact to get to know them and let them get to know you, which I think both Mark and Eric talked quite a bit about. Get out there, have that contact. And importantly, what else I heard was get your team to have that contact so that the network management doesn't rest in the hands of one person. It's really got to be multiple people. So I'm watching the clock. I know we're tight on time. Mark, I wanted to get one really quick last question out to you and probably for a quick answer, but it seems like a good one to end on. When getting started, multiple people ask the question of, how do I get and achieve some early wins? So how do you get out there and get some early wins, and what is your mindset about doing that?
And this is something that was, you know, mentioned much earlier with regard to innovation and it being a very creative process. And that idea of that creativity comes when you're really building something together, which I think builds some of the strongest relationships. And so I think wherever there's a possibility, I think that, you know, Mary's point about meeting face-to-face, absolutely critical. It's not necessary to do it always, but you're going to have a much better relationship and be able to build a better relationship if you meet somebody at a conference rather than starting up an email conversation with them. Although you can do it the other way, but that contact is important. And I would say also the hackathons and the other types of gatherings that bring people together where they work together on something, where they create something or they build something or just work on something, even if it's not finishing that pilot or that project, but to be able to work on something together, I think goes a long way as far as really establishing a relationship that allows you then to go on and nurture it, take it in what directions you want, expand it further into your organization. But I think that's a very key tool with regard to establishing something that really works.